What I will present today in my talk is here number one. It is dynamic effects of a Bose condensate, sound at non-zero temperature, and formation of the condensate. And Jörn Stenger will go ahead tomorrow and talk about optical confinement of a Bose condensate and the observation of Feshbach resonances. But before I start with the dynamic effects, let me just give some outlook where I think the field stands now in the third year of Bose-Einstein condensation. I think that if I think back a few years ago, we were hunting for an effect. We wanted to see something which was predicted in all the textbooks but not clearly observed, the phenomenon of Bose-Einstein condensation. But if you now look what we are talking about, we're talking about driven systems, we are talking about tunneling, about phase measurements, about atom lasers. I think we have gone way beyond it. So I think it is fair to say that quantum degenerate gases have developed into a new paradigm for AMO physics. And a new paradigm means that if you go to the labs, if you talk to theorists, what we are doing has changed. So if you look in the labs, in many labs you find new techniques. We are fiddling with extreme ultra-high vacuum, we are using magnetic traps, we are using new diagnostics with all those fancy cameras. And it seems we are also developing standards. There is now a standard procedure. Most people just use loading of traps with slow atomic beams, either pulsed beams from a double mod or from a Zeeman slower. They use magnetic traps, mainly of the Joffe-Pritchard type. RF evaporative cooling is standard, and absorption and dispersive imaging. Also on the theoretical side, the emphasis has shifted. A couple of years ago, people were mainly interested in what happens if an atom interacts with light. And people did wonderful work on excited state collisions. But now there is much more emphasis on the ground state. And also, people calculate coherent effects. There's more interest in wave functions than in density distributions. And we're getting more and more into the subtleties of many-body physics. Of course, if there's a new paradigm, if there is something which is central to AMO physics, it needed techniques. And the central technique, the enabling technology for all that, was the combination of laser cooling and evaporative cooling. And probably this was as central as molasses was for the field of laser cooling. And those techniques have greatly expanded the parameter space in which we can study atomic matter. If you see, temperatures are much lower than have been achieved with laser cooling, and the densities have greatly increased. And actually, these are not the latest number. We have seen atomic matter at 10 to the 15 density, and tens of nanokelvin are also standard now in a few labs. But this technique of evaporative cooling and laser cooling had something special, because once Bose-Einstein condensation was observed, we got a huge factor for free. I mean, the phase-based density just jumped up when all the atoms jump into the condensate. The density jumps up. So in that sense, on the technological aspect, Bose-Einstein condensation meant you got a lot for free. It's like free cooling. Once you reach the critical phase-based density, you get additional factors in all those parameters. However, just comparing, there's a new field, and laser cooling, evaporative cooling, and Bose-Einstein condensation is the enabling technology. If I think about laser cooling, there were many techniques needed, polarization gradient cooling, various trapping techniques, just to take advantage of this new regime in temperature and density. And so what we need now is we need nano tools to manipulate and control and diagnose atoms in that new range. And in the last year, we have sort of played around with a few tools, and that just shows you the state of the art, how we can shape now condensates by using magnetic fields and off-resonant light. We have cigar-shaped condensates, we can use detuned light, cut it into two pieces, we can vary the magnetic confinement, we can get spherical condensates, we can cut a spherical condensate. And when we did some preliminary attempts to see vortices, we created donut-shaped patterns of condensates. So all that is possible. And tomorrow, will Jörn Stenger in his talk present even more techniques how to control matter in that regime, namely all optical confinement and the control of the collisional physics by magnetic fields. So all that means we have many techniques, we have a new subfield, and the community about Bose-Einstein condensation is so strong and diverse because Bose-Einstein condensation is now becoming central for many different areas in physics, many body physics, quantum optics, atomic collisions, and probably down the road some applications. Okay, so far for an introduction. Let me now talk about dynamic properties of the Bose condensate. And the first properties which I want to discuss is sound in Bose condensed systems. I really want to skip all the experimental details because I think I'm talking to an expert audience. So this is just a generic picture how we study sound. We shake a condensate and then let it go, and then we observe the free oscillations of the system. And what you see here is you see the dipole oscillation, center of mass oscillation in the harmonic trapping potential, but more importantly, you see the quadrupolar type collective excitation, namely the condensate shrinks and stretches, and this is an internal collective excitation. Now if you take a few of these pictures and plot them all, you see many, many wiggles, and you can determine the frequency of those collective excitation with three-digit accuracy. However, Dan Stamper-Kern in my group figured out that's probably not the best way to determine frequencies because you take a few shots, other shots, and so on, and you stitch it together. What he has developed now is a single shot procedure to measure the frequency and damping rates of collective excitation. Maybe there's one technical aspect to it, but let me just comment, we can take about 20, 30 non-destructive phase contrast picture. We have 20, 30 shots in our camera, and then the film is full and we have to sort of look at the data. And what Dan Stamper-Kern figured out, the best way to take data is you first take a few shots before you excite the condensate. So we can very carefully characterize the equilibrium situation in terms of temperature and number of atoms. Then we excite it. Then we take a few shots to see the initial amplitude, a few shots here, a few shots there, and then we can fit it and get a high accuracy determination of the frequency and of the damping rate. Of course, when we go to higher temperature and the damping is more rapid, we should use a smaller temporal separation between those three bursts. But in essence, all the data which I'm going to show now were determined with this single shot measurement of a frequency and of a damping rate. But before I discuss the results, let me first discuss what is the physics of sound in a Bose condensate, what are the aspects which we want to study. And that leads me to a discussion of the various forms of sound which we encounter in a superfluid system. And in liquid helium, people have classified sound as zero, first, and second sound. And now I want to discuss what it means for a Bose condensed system. First of all, if you have a two-component system, a superfluid system at finite temperatures, you have a normal component. You have two components, and that means you have two sound modes. And those modes are classified in liquid helium as first and second sound. First sound is a density oscillation where the superfluid and the normal fluid oscillate in phase, where second sound, there is no overall density modulation because the superfluid and the normal component oscillate out of phase. So that corresponds to a temperature wave or entropy wave. However, this situation or this separation into those two modes comes about because the thermal coefficient of expansion of a fluid is very small. In a gas, this situation is very different, and this was pointed out very early by Li Huangyang and more recently by Alan Griffin and collaborators. In a gas, the two modes are separated in a different way. Namely, first sound is mainly an excitation of the thermal component, whereas second sound is an excitation of the condensate. Now I should say that that classification is only valid in the hydrodynamic limit when the mean free path between collisions is smaller than the wavelength of sound. And if you are talking about the lowest lying mode, this is synonymous with saying that the mean free path is shorter than the size of your sample. Now, in dilute gases, there is a third regime, which you might call the collisionless regime. That's a regime where your sample is shorter than the mean free path. And this is the regime which had been studied early on by MIT and also at Gila. In that case, you would classify the condensate oscillations as zero sound. And now there is another mode of the thermal component, but this is not a sound mode, it's a diffusive mode. If you have a density perturbation in a thermal gas and there are no collisions, it just diffuses out. But now in a trap, it is reflected off the walls, and that means you see density oscillations at 2 times the trap frequency, or more generally, n times the trap frequency. So all studies of both condensed gases have so far been done in this regime, where zero sound at zero temperature, or with some work at Boulder, the temperature dependence of zero sound was studied. Now, where are we in our trap with 10 million atoms in the condensate? This compares here the length scales, which are of relevance. It shows the mean free path, and it shows the length of the condensate and the length of the thermal cloud. So it tells you that the transition point is about here. For quite some regime in temperature, we are in the regime where the axial oscillations are dominated by collisions because the mean free path is short. So that means that when we observe condensate oscillation or thermal cloud oscillation in that regime, we are studying the regime of first and second sound. So here are results. This is the frequency and the damping of this oscillation, which I showed earlier, this stretching and shrinking, this quadrupole type excitation. So there are a few things which are noteworthy. The first thing is that the damping is a strong function of temperature. So far there is no quantitative theory for that, but it seems that qualitatively this can be understood as Landau damping. Shlapnikov, Liu, Stringari, Pitayevsky, Giorgini and others had models for that, but they cannot yet be quantitatively applied. But the trend is clear, and I think the physics is also fairly clear. Now, if you look at the frequency of the oscillation in the condensate, you see that the frequency decreases with temperature. So far, this is not theoretically understood. But the effect is very clear thanks to the very small error bars of this single-shot determination of frequencies. Thirdly, these points are the oscillations of the thermal cloud and, of course, extend across the transition temperature. So that means what we observe here is we observe oscillations of both the gas above the transition temperature, which are different from 2 times the trapping frequency. And that's another confirmation that we are in the regime which is collisionally dominated, and therefore this corresponds to first sound. I assume that Chris Pethick will talk much more about it, but let me just flash this transparency that several people have discussed oscillations of the thermal cloud above the critical temperature, and for very long mean free paths, the frequency is simply twice the trapping frequency, whereas in the opposite limit, another result has been derived. And now there's an interpolation formula between the two regimes, and this interpolation formula tells us that there is a one-to-one relationship between the frequency observed and the damping. And our data point seems to fit very well to the theoretical prediction. Let me point out that this is another confirmation that our excitations are collisionally dominated, because the maximum of the damping happens when you have 2 pi, about 6 collisions per oscillation time. So we are in the regime which is collisionally dominated. However, the fully hydrodynamic regime would be reached at even higher densities, and then the damping should go down to zero. Okay, I mentioned when I explained first and second sound that one feature of second sound is that it is an out-of-phase oscillation of the superfluid and the normal component. Now, I later explained that what is second sound in a dilute Bose gas are mainly oscillations of the condensate, but there will be a very small contribution of the thermal cloud, which sort of wiggles out of phase. So in all cases, the characteristic feature of second sound is an out-of-phase oscillation, but we cannot see it in the dilute gas because the component of the out-of-phase component of the thermal cloud is very small. However, there's one exception, and that was pointed out by Griffin and collaborators, namely the dipolar oscillation. If you have a condensate and a thermal cloud, you can have a center of mass oscillation of both clouds together, or you can have an out-of-phase oscillation. And this is the oscillation where you can see the out-of-phase character, which is characteristic for second sound. The problem was how to excite it, because if we wiggle the cloud magnetically, we would excite both components in phase. But now we can use this, our nano tools, this far-off resonant laser light, and if we focus blue detuned laser light, we create such a blip in the potential. And now with a motorized mirror, we can just take this laser and move it and shake the thermal cloud, but not touch the condensate. So in that way, we can selectively excite relative motion between the two components and therefore realize this out-of-phase oscillation. Now, I usually like to show some raw data. So this is a strip chart, and I will show you an animated version in a moment. It's a little bit subtle, so you have to look carefully. This here marks the laser beam. So we come, displace the thermal cloud, and move it back. So this is a full cycle excitation. And then what happens? You see the thermal cloud, it oscillates. Okay, we drove it. But if you look at the condensate first almost stands still, but now it gains momentum and starts oscillating. Let me show you that in a computer, in animation of data. All right. So this is the condensate and the thermal cloud. Now we come with a laser beam, with a light sheet, displace the thermal cloud, but don't touch the condensate and move it back. So this is the full cycle excitation. And now I repeat many times what happens in the next cycle. I think you see how the thermal cloud is now freely oscillating with quite some amplitude, but the condensate is just oscillating a little bit. It almost stands still. So this is the cycle where you see strong relative motion between the two components. Okay, in a few seconds we will then see the full action. So we excite the cloud, the thermal cloud moves, but I mark the condensate, and you can clearly see how it takes a while for the condensate to gain momentum. So it is the thermal cloud which drives the condensate. And after a while, you can see it again, but after a few cycles, you see that the two components, the superfluid and the normal component, lock up. Now it's pretty much the motion of a rigid body. I think you can look at it once more in a little bit faster display, and what you should see is in the first second there is something sort of out of phase, but then the two systems lock up and now they just move like a rigid body. Okay, so if you can see something almost with the naked eye, it's easy to evaluate it. So what is shown here is how the condensate catches up momentum, and then we subtract the constant center of mass oscillation and obtain the relative motion of the condensate within the thermal cloud. So we think that this mode is special for the following two reasons. Number one, it displays very nicely the anti-symmetric character, which is characteristic for second sound. And number two is, if you think about it, what you've just seen, you have seen the relative motion of a superfluid component relative to the thermal background. So that's like a superfluid component moving and the thermal background is not moving. Okay, let me summarize. Where do we stand with our basic concepts about sound? Yes? Yes, oh, thanks for the question. When we analyzed this frequency, we saw that this out-of-phase motion has a frequency which is 5 to 10% smaller than the frequency of the dipole motion. And actually, it's smaller than the frequency of the center of mass motion. And actually, it's curious, but it's about the same frequency shift which we saw here for the quadrupolar motion. So somehow, maybe both shifts can be explained in some comprehensive model, which maybe assumes that when a condensate moves relative to a thermal cloud, that the thermal cloud is sort of shielding the harmonic oscillator potential and creating a potential for the condensate which has a smaller effective frequency. But I'm just making a suggestion. Anyway, what is the state of sound? If I think back 3 years ago, nobody knew what second sound would be. We started thinking about discrete modes, wiggles of the condensate, but we didn't really know how this would be connected to phonons and the speed of sound. And so I think it's very pleasing to see a fairly complete picture emerging where discrete modes has been studied in the collisionless regime, more recently now in the hydrodynamic regime, second and first sound, it's clear what to observe. We have also studied propagation of sound and measured the speed of sound. I don't have time to talk about that. But that, together with all the theory which was developed in parallel, I think gives a very complete picture of the basic effects. We know what the different modes of sound are, and something which I think is also closing the circle is recent work by Sandro Stringari. I assume he might talk about that, but for the geometry where we studied the propagation of sound, he really treated with a uniform treatment a discrete mode and the continuum of phonons. So we know now very well how eventually the spectrum of discrete modes goes over into the phonon continuum. Now, after we have this basic understanding, there are, of course, many more complicated things which we might attack now. And this is just a list of buzzwords. I don't want to go too deeply into it. And I assume Sandro, Chris Pethick, Yvon Castin, they will talk about many aspects which I still call sound, but some of them are really the feature of a strongly driven system which shows nonlinear effects and other things. Okay, so this is one aspect of the dynamics of a condensate, sound and its various variants. But let me now come to the second part of my talk, discussing the formation of the condensate. And actually, the formation of the condensate links up with the atom laser discussion which we had this morning. Because the formation of the condensate involves bosonic stimulation, and this is the gain process of the atom laser. Now, people have discussed various aspects of the atom laser, but let me just briefly summarize that there are several schemes how to get an atom laser. People have discussed for long that you can get a macroscopic population in an atom cavity by optical pumping and then couple out this lasing mode. And a special realization of that is the Bose-Einstein condensate, where the lasing mode is the ground state of the system. And in previous work, we have discussed how to generate those beams and how to get the coherence. Let me just say one or two sentences about the coherence, but then for the rest of my talk, I want to discuss the last issue, namely the fact that both condensates are produced with a stimulated process. So I want to discuss bosonic stimulation in the formation of a condensate. But let me just make a couple of remarks about the coherence of the condensate. The way how we showed the coherence was that we took created two condensates and interfered them. Now, Carl Wieman has nicely discussed another way how to make a condensate interferometer, and I want to just to point out the similarities and the differences. I mean, in some of our work, we produced two condensates by evaporative cooling and a double well potential. But for instance, for those data and for other experiments we did, we took one condensate, split it, and then released it from the trap, recombined it in the overlap region and measured the interference signal. This is a condensate interferometer. Carl Wieman showed us today that there's a second way to do it, namely you take one condensate, split it between two different hyperfine states, let it sort of dwell for a while, and then recombine it. So I think there is some analogy which is similar to the classification we have been using with atom interferometers. There are those separated beam-type atom interferometers on the one hand, but then there are these atom interferometers which were called REMSI interferometers or internal state interferometers, and it seems that both interferometers have now been realized for both condensates. I just want to show this because that's something which came out. Did it come out, Hartmut, in Europhysics letter? Or I have only seen the preprint, but anyway, I just want to show that this is a quantitative comparison between our interference results and theory done by the Garching group. And for me, this is actually the most convincing evidence which we have that a Bose condensate can be described by a single wave function by a solution of the nonlinear Schrödinger equation. Because all details of various interference patterns which we saw were fully quantitatively accounted for by the theory. Okay, but I don't want to talk much more about coherence. I want to talk about bosonic stimulation and the formation of the condensate. And so what I want to talk about it, that a condensate forms in a process which is very analogous how light is amplified in a laser. Because if you have a coherent matter wave or a condensate, it interacts with an ultra-cold cloud of atoms, that's the thermal component, you get an amplified Bose condensate. And the elementary process for this amplification is stimulated scattering. If two atoms collide in excited states of the trap, and we have already a condensate with n-naught atoms, the probability that one of these atoms will join the condensate is n-naught plus 1 times enhanced. Now, I know that some people get confused if there is some mysterious force, so it doesn't hurt to point out that this enhancement is purely due to symmetry. And you can explain it in the simplest way by just saying, if you use fully symmetrized wave function, as you have to do for indistinguishable particles, this atom has n-naught plus 1 possibilities to jump into the condensate, or more precisely, there are n-naught plus 1 times plus 1 terms, and this gives the enhancement. So it is very closely related to quantum statistics. And the way how we investigated that was the following way. If you start, let's just assume we have a small condensate, everything is in equilibrium. Then we can prepare a non-equilibrium situation by removing the high energy tail of the condensate in the of the thermal cloud. And after that, we leave the system alone. It thermalizes, goes back into equilibrium, but now at a lower temperature because that's sort of a single-step evaporative cooling. And now at a lower temperature, there are more atoms in the condensate, so we have gain. We amplify the condensate from here to there. Now, what do we expect to see when we have a non-equilibrium situation? If the growth of the condensate is based on bosonic stimulation, that's the physics of exponential growth, and then ultimately the growth saturates. I mean, all exponential processes have to saturate sooner or later, and that's how that gives us the final equilibrium. I should point out that this process is distinctly different from an ordinary thermal relaxation process, where the rate of change is fast first, and then it approaches asymptotically the equilibrium. Let me point out that Crispin Gardiner, Peter Zoller, and others formulated a microscopic theory based on quantum kinetic theory, which in its simplest case reduces to that equation, and it also tells us what to choose for this exponent, namely a 2/5. Okay, so when we did the experiment, we cooled a cloud to the onset of Bose-Einstein condensation, then we did a very fast IF sweep to do the truncation of the thermal tail, and then we just watched. We watched what happens in a completely isolated system. And we used our non-destructive phase contrast imaging technique so we can watch the formation of the condensate without disturbing it. And for a while nothing happens, but then the condensate grew. And when we compared the growth curve of the condensate with this theoretical model, we found the shape of the growth was in quantitative agreement with this differential equation which I showed earlier. But just to point out the basic effect, if there is a condensate, it grows immediately. But if you don't have a condensate, bosonic stimulation means you have to get the avalanche rolling, so it doesn't grow for a while, but then it grows fast. We have studied with higher resolution the early moments of the formation, which I think gives a nice picture of what's happening. At time t equals zero, we sort of swept out the high energy tail of the distribution. And within the next few milliseconds, all the half of the atoms left the trap. But then it's an isolated system and the number stays constant. Slowly the condensate grows, but you also see when we monitored the width of the thermal cloud, the width square is a measure of the temperature, that during the preparation the temperature suddenly dropped, a few collective excitation, but basically it's constant. So that means you might want to describe the formation process as a cloud which is rapidly undercooled to a temperature below TC, and then you have a supersaturated quantum vapor, and out of this quantum vapor the condensate grows. Okay, so the functional shape of the curve seems to confirm the theoretical prediction, but when we looked at the rate parameter, how fast does the condensate grow, we found a discrepancy. I mean, this plots some of our data which were taken at different temperatures and for different equilibrium condensates after the system had reached equilibrium. And when we compared it with the theory by Zola and Gardiner, we found a discrepancy. First of all, the theory predicted a slower growth, but there has been a recent preprint by the same group saying that the inclusion of Bose statistics and of scattering effects is speeding it up. So probably most of this discrepancy has already been closed. However, there's another effect which maybe it's nice for discussion here. We see that we see an opposite trend as a function of the number of atoms in the condensate. And maybe this is related to something which you might want to call gain saturation. That we maybe the condensates are getting so big that the gain is no longer linear. But I don't really know what I'm talking about and I want to leave it for discussion. Okay, so let me come to the third part of my talk, which is 5 minutes. I'm talking 35 minutes now. Yeah. It's 45 plus discussion? Oh, sorry, I was counting on 45 plus 5, but... Okay, maybe it's, I need something like 10 minutes. Okay, fine, thanks. Okay, now I want to talk about the possibility of creating a condensate adiabatically, and then I will maybe discuss that it opens new ways to study the formation of the condensate. So let me first discuss in general, is it possible to do an adiabatic formation of a condensate, because adiabatic means you're not changing the entropy. And your first, maybe the quick answer might be no, because you all know the inscription of the Boltzmann Memorial in Vienna, which tells us that entropy is related to the thermodynamic probability. In more modern notation, that means that the rigorously defined entropy per particle is related to the peak phase-based density. And since both condensation needs a critical phase-based density, the conclusion is, if you don't change the entropy, you cannot change the phase-based density. But there is a constant. And this constant, as was discussed by Walraven's group, depends on the shape of the potential. So if you change the shape of your potential, then you can change this constant, which means if you say entropy is constant and you solve for the phase-based density, the phase-based density will change as a function of this constant. And for the most extreme case, if you go from a flat bottom potential, nobody has made one, to a pointy potential, which is very unstable, you can increase the phase-based density by 20. And the Amsterdam group showed by going from a rounded to a more pointy potential that indeed they could change the phase-based density by a factor of 2. But we figured out that you can actually get much more change in the phase-based density. And let me just introduce the simple idea with this two-box model. Assume you have a cloud in a box potential, and now you add this deep potential well. And let's assume the well is very small, so not too many atoms fit into it. And if you adiabatically create this extra well, then after it's done, you have the same temperature because not too many atoms could fall into it, and you still have the same density up there. But the density down there is larger by a Boltzmann factor. And that can give infinite increase of phase-based density. Or to say it in a very simple way, assume you have a big gas volume and you compress a small part of it. If you compress it, you heat it up and the phase-based density does not change. But if the atoms around take over the heat, then you have just increased the density and not the temperature. So how can we realize that? That is something I want to leave to Jörn Stenger tomorrow, but when we use a magnetic thread, which I call the big box, and focus a reticuned laser beam in, we can create a big box with a dimple. And we can adjust the depth of this dimple simply by varying the laser power of the laser beam which we focus into the trap. So that's the system, and what I want to show you is that there's very interesting physics if you have an harmonic oscillator with a dimple. So the prediction is that we should tremendously increase the phase-based density by adding such a dimple. Now this phase-based density increase is only local. Now if we do a time of flight, we would sort of measure something global. How can we measure local phase-based density? It's fairly simple because we can use the Bose condensate as a phase-space density meter. If we cool down, let's say a factor of 20 away from Bose condensation, and then switch on the laser and measure how much power is necessary to see the appearance of a condensate, we can measure the phase-based density here in the normal way, and the condensate tells us that the local phase-based density is 2.6. And the second way is we can just go to the onset of Bose condensation, sort of zero condensate fraction, switch on the laser and measure the number of atoms in the condensate. Now, this is the result where some factor away from Bose condensation and measured the depth of the dimple which is necessary to quench the system into Bose condensation. And we saw increases of the phase-based density of a factor of 50, more than you can get theoretically with any power law potential. And we were also able to start with zero condensate fraction, ramp up the laser power, and get up to 30% condensate fraction. We got condensates of 15 million atoms in that way. The fact that those curves are smaller than the theoretical prediction and that they roll over has something to do with violation of adiabaticity and of free-body recombination. I don't want to go into the details here. But let me show you something else, which I hope just gives you the fun of those potentials with a dimple. If you look at the shape of the thermal cloud in time of flight, you measure the energy distribution, and I ask you, when do you expect Bose-Einstein statistics? When do you expect Maxwell-Boltzmann statistics? Now, if we are below the critical temperature and you see the small condensate, we should use Bose-Einstein statistics. What we do is we fit the distribution to the wing, because in the wings the physics is simple, and then we see how does it fit in the central part. So here this is clearly Bose-Einstein statistics. But high above the transition temperature, Bose-Einstein statistics does not fit. Of course, we have to use Maxwell-Boltzmann statistics. Just to point that out, when I say Bose-Einstein statistics, I mean chemical potential zero, and Maxwell-Boltzmann statistics is Bose-Einstein statistics for a large negative value of the chemical potential. In any case, I think that's probably the first time that this difference has clearly been shown with a thermal cloud of atoms. But now comes the question, what would you expect in this trap with a dimple? In this trap with a dimple, we see a condensate, but we see a purely classical thermal cloud. What's going on? Is that in contradiction to something we have learned in statistical mechanics? The answer is no, but we have a new degree of freedom. Because if we have a condensate in the normal magnetic trap, the chemical potential has to be zero. But if the condensate forms down here in the dimple, the chemical potential has a large negative value, and all of this gas behaves classically. Okay, now I said it's an adiabatic process. And if it's an adiabatic process, it should be reversible. We should be able to cross the transition lines back and forth. And that is shown here. It shows time of light distribution, and we vary the laser power. We form a condensate, reduce the laser power, the condensate goes away. So we form the condensate 15 times in a row. So I think there are a few atoms who have experienced 15 Bose condensations, which is probably a rare pleasure. Okay. So we think that if you can go back and forth under very reproducible conditions, it's very nice to study the dynamics of condensate formation. So what is shown here is the formation of the condensate when we change the laser power. And the very intriguing question is, here there is no condensate and we form another one. Is there phase memory? Maybe there is one atom in the ground state which seeds the phase for the next formation. That would be interesting to find out. And there's another thing which we did. When we fitted those curves and compared it with the sinusoidal curve for the laser power, we saw that the condensate was lagging 70 milliseconds behind. So that's another way of measuring the formation time. It's called the phase shift method of measuring lifetimes, and it's common in atomic physics. Okay, two more transparencies. I hope I've shown to you that a track with a dimple has many new features. In that situation, we have seen transition temperatures as high as 5 microkelvin, which corresponds to a density of a thermal cloud of 5 times 10 to the 14. Both values are unprecedented. It's a neat potential because it allows us a free adjustment of the chemical potential, as I pointed out. It also means that the thermodynamic behavior in this potential is richer than in a harmonic oscillator. Sandro Stringari has shown that in a harmonic oscillator, everything scales and there's only one dimensionless variable. We think here there is one more knob to turn. Finally, if you want to study the formation of the condensate, it's adiabatic and reversible. You can study the formation time. But we also think what is very important is we can quench the system from equilibrium to a situation where it should form a condensate in microseconds. So we think it's a much cleaner way of preparing a sample and studying the formation. Finally, I should point out that we saw formation times in that situation by suddenly switching on this laser beam, which were considerably faster than the axial oscillation time. And we really saw weird condensates which were oscillating. So maybe what was formed here were quasi-condensates, which didn't have time to find the final equilibrium. But more on the practical side, I think this is a nice booster for phase-based density. If for some reason your experiment reaches Bose condensation within a factor of 50, switch on this laser and you can quench it into Bose condensation. And secondly, but Jörn Stenger will talk much more about it tomorrow, this effect greatly helps for the transfer of condensate atoms into purely optical trap. The last transparency is just the final note. It seems that with this adiabatic formation, we found a new way of cooling into Bose-Einstein condensation, which is different from evaporative cooling. But if you think about it, I think the whole process of evaporative cooling could also be obtained by just deformation of the trapping potential. The way how we do our F evaporation is we sort of punch a hole in the potential and pull down the hole and cool to lower and lower temperature. Alternatively, we could just open up the harmonic trap at a certain point in a big box and sort of lower this point. Or in other words, if you want to evaporate, there is no need to trash the atoms. You could as well keep them in your potential. So in that sense, it's not absolutely necessary to regard evaporative cooling as a dissipation process where you lose your atoms for good. On the other hand, I don't see any special reason why you should keep those atoms. It's probably easier to just trash them. Okay, I think I should stop here and keep a few minutes for the discussion. I haven't thought of that. I thought Gross-Peterjewski is valid in every potential.
Can you repeat more slowly? You know,
no, just speculating that with these very enharmonic tracks, it may be necessary to rethink some of the theorems which you and Ivanka found others have proved about the validity of the time-dependent Gross-Peterjewski equation.
What is the real question? Approximately when we have some situation, when we have the trap and change in a large scale, but not in a small oscillation, large scale, change of the curve, where we are able to have some solution, exact solution, for example, in two-dimensional cases, absolutely exact solution for any time-dependent change, and you may get temperature is zero. The question about attenuation, for example, absolutely open up to this moment. But if the temperature is zero, that's why there is no interaction with above condensate particles, which Kessel discussed. So the problem of unharmonicity just in this case does not play essential role. It's necessary to be more careful. The situation which was discussed, it was the conservation of parabolic well, but the change of the frequency of parabolic well in arbitrary time dependence. If you have the situation in a three-dimensional case, you change this unharmonicity, you would have some attenuation of the oscillation, because it will be some chaos. Chaos, and it will be imitation of attenuation. It's not real attenuation, it's imitation of attenuation.
You know?
Okay.
So you might well get
okay, I mean, you can of course turn it around. How much condensate has to be left to act as phase memory?
If you completely destroy condensate, then
I think I've discussed in general what can happen if you deform a potential, and I think if you have a magnetized needle which creates magnetically a dimple in the potential, I would expect the physics to be very similar. When I think most of the effects are very general, I mean, if I say there is a small region where you compress the gas to high density, then
many experiments made in simple-rate hydrogen just with such a geometry, large volume, small volume, which is conditionally named magnetic needles, where you have very severe increasing of the density.
Yes.
When you have low density just in the buffer volume, and you can have what the condensation just in this small volume, when in large volume you would have no water condensation. So it's
so in that sense this is similar.
It's the same.